Welcome to the Executive Access Podcast. I'm Mark Feinsand of MLB.com, and I'm joined today by President and CEO of the Toronto Blue Jays, Mark Shapiro. Mark, how are you?
Good, Mark. It's good to be with you.
I appreciate you taking some time. I'll start this off by asking you the same first question I ask everybody, which is, how did you get your first job in baseball?
Oh, my first job in baseball. Well, a lot of people know my dad, back in the 80s was an agent. He had kind of happened into that by helping Brooks Robinson out of bankruptcy. And I was working for my first job out of college in Southern California for a big real estate developer. And I just flew out to Phoenix just to spend a couple days with my dad as he toured camps and saw his players. And from that time, I met with, Joe McElvain, Jim Beattie, these guys were executives, and John Hart and Dan O'Dowd. And, I was unhappy at my first job, which is not unusual. And of course, like every 22-year-old kid, I was like, I want to work in baseball. And my dad said, you don't want to be an agent, and didn't even open that avenue to me. And so I wrote 26. There weren't 30. There were 26 teams. I wrote 26, resumes and cover letters and sent them out. Didn't hear back from many. Joe McElvain was great. Spent time with him. He was with the Padres back then. And about 8 months after I sent the letters, I got a call from Dan O'Dowd, who was the assistant GM with the Indians. And the Indians were the worst team in all of baseball. They lost 104 games in 1991. And it was a generic entry-level job with no title, just assistant baseball ops at a pay cut in Cleveland, which was not exactly the movie Major League was pretty much all anyone knew it for. and I couldn't wait, especially I think more about John Hart and Dan O'Dowd and their vision for the organization with the new stadium coming 2 years down the line. And they were just people that I wanted to work for and work with. So I drove a U-Haul truck into Cleveland in January of 1992 and took that job on a really buying into people more than anything else.
You mentioned your dad was an agent. You grew up in Baltimore. I assume you were an Orioles fan?
Oh, off the hook, yeah. I mean, those were the, baseball was just part of the fabric of my relationship with my dad and my childhood. And, we had season tickets to Oriole games in Memorial Stadium. And, it was, the love of the game from just being fans until I was, because for the first 13 years of my life, we were just fans. That's all my dad was, just a guy that loved baseball and was a passion for him that he passed on to me. So wiffle ball, stick ball, baseball, it didn't matter. We were either going to games or playing. And then all of a sudden at 13, the same guys I was hanging over the rail trying to get autographs started coming into our house. So, Eddie Murray and Jim Palmer and Rick Dempsey and Mark Belanger and, all these guys are, Cal Ripken Jr., all these guys are in our house, having dinner with us. And so that was kind of weird and kind of bizarre. But it always has been for me part of the perspective I've tried to carry into, running a front office and being around players, which is, our job aligns with trying to help players be the best they can be 99% of the time. There's only 1% of the time we work against them, and that's contract time. The rest of the time, we all benefit. And so the more we can genuinely and authentically communicate to a player that we care about them, that we're pulling for them, that we're here to help them, to find the best resources, to help put them in a position to be successful, if your relationship can always get back to that and be defined by that, you've got a chance to build an organization players want to play in, and I think get the best out of players too.
You mentioned John Hart, you mentioned Dan O'Dowd. I assume those are two of the bigger influences early in your career. What did you learn most working under them?
Yeah, that's easy. For John, empowerment. For me to have been a 25-year-old guy that they turned the player development system over to as a farm director, and for John to tell me, for me to walk into John's office at 25 years old and say, hey, I want to develop an individual player plan system for every player and want to think about developing players holistically, mentally, physically, and fundamentally, and I'm going to do it respectfully, I'm going to earn respect, and for John to just say, hey, you're a guy, I got your back, I believe in you, and for him to empower me at the level he did, I didn't fully appreciate it at that age. Now I look back at the young guys in our office and think, holy cow, how much he believed in me. The power of that belief is immeasurable. And so I've tried to pay that forward, that level of empowerment, that level of belief, and understand what that can mean from John.
It's almost like you're reading my questions in advance. On the pay it forward front, I did these podcasts with all 30 GMs during spring training. I feel like I asked maybe a third of them, what they learned working under you. You've got a very impressive tree, so to speak, of guys who are major executives around the game, from Chris Antonetti, Mike Chernoff, Ross Atkins, obviously, Derek Falvey, Mike Hazen, Neil Huntington, David Stearns. It's a pretty impressive list, and that doesn't even include recent GMs like Ben Cherington and Josh Burns. What's it like for you to see all of these guys who worked under you, who were that young, up-and-coming guy, go on to these kinds of levels?
I mean, I you know, listen, it's, we're all in this to win a World Series, but I kind of believe more that the process leads to the result. And so I've always viewed making it a great place to work and in investing and developing people and helping them to be the best they can be and helping them realize their goals and get their dreams to be part of the job. And so I guess what I'd say is I get a tremendous, maybe the most fulfillment professionally out of seeing those people do great things and achieve great things. And I, you know, I celebrate, you know, with them when they celebrate. You know, I bleed with them when they bleed. When we play them, I still want to beat them. You know, it's just like a little brother you play. That's how I felt when we played Cleveland last year, you know, in the playoffs. But, you know, I love those guys and I care about them and I'm pulling for them. And, you know, in some ways, you know, I played some role, small role, you know, in them. You know, getting the opportunities they've got, they played just as big, if not a bigger role in helping me grow, because a big part of that, Mark, is those guys challenging us to continue to learn and grow. And I think grow, you know, a learning environment, a learning culture comes from getting really bright and talented people in and then, you know, turning them loose, empowering them to help make us better and creating that understanding that that's what we're about, whether it be the intern, directors, you know, or the GM. We want to create an environment where everybody's, you know, looking to get the decisions right and get them and grow and get better as an organization all the time. So those guys, while I was around them, challenged me, you know, and helped me grow and learn to stay relevant, because it's now been over 25 years, so I've got to stay relevant, you know.
You mentioned that ALCS against the Indians last year. I know a lot of people asked you at the time what your emotions going into the series against your old team. Having had, you know, 10 months or so to reflect on that and look back on it, what was that experience like of going into an ALCS against a team that you were largely responsible for helping build?
It was a little surreal, a little bizarre. You know, when we were playing the games, it wasn't mixed at all. Like, I wanted to beat those guys. Sure. Just like I think, you know, Serena Williams feels when she plays Venus Williams. Right. It was no, like, you know, there's no gray there. You know, like, you're a competitive person. You're in this to win. You know, I wasn't feeling charitable towards people I care about. And, like, however, you know, I had 24 years invested in that organization from top to bottom, the people. So the second it was over, you know, after I had a moment to kind of grieve, my focus turned to pulling for those guys and really wanting them to finish that and, like, feeling a part of it. And whether it be most of those players, I had a small piece or role in kind of developing, either drafting or, you know, helping to trade for or being a part of, or whether it be, you know, Chris, Mike, you know, all people, the Carter Hawkins, people up and down the organization that, you know, I can remember coming in and learning and growing, or the player development system in general. It's not that easy just to detach. I mean, it's going to take years for me to not feel a part of the Indian organization. That's a good thing, I think. That's not a bad thing. So the other places, I'm just a part of the person. The Indians, I'm a part of the organization, and that doesn't, you know, that's 24 years invested in that. That'll take a long time to probably not be as meaningful to me.
If my math is right, when you left Cleveland, you had spent half of your life there.
I spent just about half my life there. It's true. Yeah.
So knowing that city, knowing what it's, you know, sort of the evolution of that downtown area and just the fan base, what do you think it meant for them when the Cavaliers won a championship there, and in turn to then see the Indians in the World Series again so soon after that, and just sort of that rebirth of sports in Cleveland?
I think Cleveland is a great example of the power of sport and what sport can do to, maybe disproportionately, and maybe it's a little bit out of whack and not necessarily a great statement about our culture, but sports has the power to lift psyche and lift spirit. And Cleveland, because it is a smaller city and it's one of these cities that kind of has a, you know, a little bit of, like, if you're from there, my kids, believe me, man, they bleed, they're 216, they wear it on their shirts and they, you know, they still feel like they're going to be Cleveland kids their whole lives.
So I'm sure the Kyrie trade was a popular topic amongst your family.
My son, for sure. Just my son. You know, like, so, I mean, that's something that's never going to go away, you know. So I think there's like a pride like that. Other people don't give us the respect or recognize the positive things about Cleveland. So that makes people that are there even more close-knit. And so being able to have success at the highest level and the biggest stage forces the outside world to look at them in a more positive light. And so there's pride. It's just it's a point of pride, incredible point of pride.
You mentioned you started with the Indians as a baseball operations assistant in the early 90s. You moved up through the ranks. You farm director, you ran the Latin American operations, you're the vice president of baseball operations, a lot of job titles.
Yeah.
Was GM always the ultimate goal for you?
Great question. I never, this is the honest answer, I never felt like I had to achieve a certain level or a certain job, you know, to be successful or have arrived or have doing something. I felt that leading was extremely important to me, that I enjoy leading people. I enjoy helping people come together to achieve something great. And I felt that continuing to grow, develop, and learn and be challenged was important. So what the different jobs, less the titles, but what the different roles and jobs did for me was never caused me to stagnate, always allowed me to grow and learn and continue to get better, always challenged me that there was a new set of responsibilities that I had to, you know, adapt to, including the business side when I became team president over there. I think that progression really fulfilled me and satisfied me from that perspective, that I had to continue to learn something new and I had to continue to earn respect from people and have a different platform to lead.
I think most fans understand what a general manager does. When you were promoted from GM to president in Cleveland, mm-hmm. How did your job change the most?
Well, it changed the most because for 17 years, I had only looked at the game through the lens of baseball operations, which is half the team business, and had never even really thought it, at any level of depth or understood either ownership league issues or the business side. And then when I became team president, you know, the business, you know, a whole other group of people and human beings that live and die for the team that, you know, while they're not on the player personnel side, are still very important to the business. I became accountable and, you know, I felt like responsible for their fulfillment and their happiness and their development and their growth, as well as I was able to start to interact at the league level, and which I have really enjoyed that, you know. So, and that's, whether it's the competition committee or the strategic planning committee or attending ownership meetings, that's given me, I think at this point of my career, a lens to be able to think about, hey, how can I help improve the game? How can I help make the game better? How can I help the game evolve? You know, how can I use some of my experience and my energy to just impact the game that I love and make sure it's in a better place, you know, when I'm done?
That said, is it tough? I'm sure, obviously, you're still involved in baseball operations, you know, at a very high level. Is it tough to turn the day-to-day running of the baseball operations over to someone else, even somebody who you've essentially groomed to take that job?
Yeah, in Cleveland, initially no. Just because I don't just believe in Chris. I love Chris Antonetti, and I probably think that there's not a better executive. You know, I mean, I would think Theo Epstein's probably the best executive in the history of baseball. But you know, I think that,
what's he accomplished?
Yeah, but I think that I think that there's not a better GM than Chris Antonetti, or a better head of baseball operations than Chris Antonetti. And so knowing that, you know, like, I'm not better than him. You know, like, I want the Indians to be successful, right? So I want Chris to be in that job. And easy to step aside, but easy to still feel connected, because the roots weren't just being a GM there for 7 years. The roots were before that assistant GM, before that farm director. So everywhere I went, there were people, you know, that I had been around or had touched me in some way. What it's done moving over here to Toronto has allowed me to get back involved in baseball operations in a way where I feel like I can still make a difference and help and make an impact. Ross is still the GM day to day. I am not doing the player moves. I'm not doing the, you know, when there's an injury, who's coming up. I'm not, but, you know, Ross, I can help you know, because he's a, you know, he's in his, you know, infancy or first couple years of being a GM. So I can spend time with him. You know, he wasn't an assistant GM where Chris was. So I can spend time with Ross, you know, as he walks through some of the challenges as he grows in that role. And I would say 5 years, Ross probably is not going to need me either. You know, but right now I can still help and I can still be a resource for him and for the organization as we evolve over here and grow over here and really modernize some of our systems over here.
I would assume that a lot of that GM and baseball operations job is about relationships as well. And so having 25 years of relationships that he couldn't possibly have just based on his age, that probably plays a big role in you being able to do what you do here as well in terms of baseball ops.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the, you know, the relationships and the people change over time. So I think you're...
Well, most of them work for you.
So you're, you know, so to, you know, I think you're, you, that's why it's just so important to stay relevant and keep bringing in new talented young guys and continuing to give them opportunity to impact the organization. And, you know, I think, again, Ross, if I wasn't here, Ross would still be great and be fine. But, you know, just I'm one more set of experiences and one more set of perspectives that, you know, hopefully can help both him and, you know, some of the other people to continue to get better here.
You were portrayed in the movie Moneyball. I'm sure you've been asked your opinion on the movie and the actor who played you 100 times. So I'll ask you a different question. What's a better baseball movie, Moneyball or Major League? You're in one and you work for the other organization for half your life.
Yeah. I mean, Major League was more entertaining than it because it didn't try to be true to life.
Right.
You know, Moneyball was actually interesting because I think it obviously... to the outside, I always like say, hey, it's probably like the emergency room for doctors, you know, ER, and legal dramas for lawyers are like, that's not even accurate, you know. You know, Moneyball tried to take 3 or 4 years and condense it in the 90 minutes. To do that, you have to take a lot of liberties with what actually happened and kind of condense it. So I find myself distracted by the things that aren't accurate or the things that didn't actually happen or the fact I wasn't even a GM yet when that, you know, when I was being portrayed as a GM. So
minor details.
Yeah, so I find I get distracted by that. Whereas in Major League, you're not get distracted. You're just
laughing.
Yeah, you're just laughing, yeah.
So after spending 24 years with the Indians, how difficult of a decision was it for you to leave for the Blue Jays?
It's difficult, you know. It's difficult largely because of the people, you know, that you care about and you're tied to. I think it took two things. It took a compelling situation, which I feel like Toronto was, because it had so many unique, you know, attributes of things that were important to me, and everybody's different in what they're looking for. And then two, it took the support of my family, you know, the willingness to consider an adventure, you know, and leaving a place they'd been their whole lives with me. So those two things, but, you know, it wasn't like I was out of work, you know, so it was it wasn't like there weren't things along the way that we also considered elsewhere. This just felt like the right opportunity at the right time, both things.
After you took the job with Toronto, the Indians had you catch the ceremonial first pitches from both of your kids. What did that mean to you to be out there with them?
Man, I'm getting like emotional kind of thinking about that. It was, yeah, family and baseball are kind of the only things in my life. You know, I'm not a hobby guy. I don't play golf. I don't play cards. I don't, you know, go on ridiculous vacations. Like, you know, I've got baseball and my job, my work, which is, and my family, and that's it. So those were kind of a point of, and I don't tend to be someone that spends a lot of time reflecting. I just want to keep moving forward. So that was a day and a moment of reflection a little bit on, holy cow, I can't believe it's been 24 years since I walked up the, you know, the staircase in Gate A and, you know, Municipal Stadium in Cleveland and to John Hart's office with the space heater and the plastic plant and the missing ceiling tiles. And, you know,
it sounds like Major League.
it really wasn't that far from it in Municipal Stadium, you know. So to you know, just think, reflecting on that, you know, that 24 years, it's a long time. So
you've run teams in the pre-analytics era.
Yes.
You've run teams now. How have analytics most changed the game and the way that front offices approach putting teams together?
Hard to give a succinct answer to that because, you
that's
know,
that's a pretty wide-ranging question.
Yeah, because when you think back to how we made decisions, you know, and I would say the interesting, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, when you were just making decisions off scouts and, you know, some some Xerox copies of the media guide and, you know, some medical, you know, reports. You were still kind of doing the same thing, but you were doing it with the only information you had available. And as organizations began to evolve and decision-making evolved, there became a thirst for what is the best information we can have to make decisions, and where are there competitive, you know, advantages and potential inefficiencies that we can exploit. The interesting thing is we're probably getting to a tipping point where there are very few, in the way we make decisions, there are very few competitive advantages left. So many front offices now are making decisions in a similar way. So many front offices now are structured in a similar way. So it's not just the Indians tree. It's, you know, you take Andrew Friedman and he's gone from Tampa, you know, to, he's gone from a small market to a large market. You take Theo, he's gone from Boston to Chicago. So it's now at a point where, you know, a lot of the large market teams are being run like small market teams. This is the shortest answer I can give you to summarize it. When I first became GM, Mark, our greatest advantage lied in the fact that the large market teams were strictly focused on free agency as kind of a way to exploit their resources. At some point, and I think Theo really is the one that started this, someone realized, and Theo realized, that if we run a large market team like a small market team and exploit our resources not just on major league free agents, but in player development and scouting and analytics and front office alignment and staffing and resources and every tool we've got, that we've got a chance to be really effective. And then everybody else course corrected to him. We lost, as a small market team, the greatest competitive advantage, and now we're looking for that in other places, you know. So, you know, that has dramatically changed from raising hands and with stat books on our laps and scouting reports, you know, files open on desks, to, you know, an incredible amount of proprietary analytics and analytics staffs. And front offices have gone from 6 guys to 20 guys.
It seems like a lot of executives that I've spoken to think sports science could be the next sort of area that teams try to find that next competitive advantage in. Do you think that's an area that could develop, where if a team figures out, hey, we found the secret to keeping our pitchers from blowing out their elbows, or or do you think there's another area that teams might look at to try to find that next wave of advantage?
Yeah, I think on the medical performance side, you know, recovery side, there's still opportunities. Whether they're the biggest ones, I'm not sure. I think crazily enough, that coaching and development is probably something we don't do extremely well as an industry, and that there's probably huge opportunities there as well.
After not reaching the postseason for 22 years, how much have the past few years in Toronto injected life into this fan base? The city's known as a hockey town,
yeah,
and yet the last couple of Octobers, it's been pretty baseball crazy.
Yeah, and so I've only seen a very limited window, so it's almost hard for me to appreciate, except from hearing people around the building talk about what it was like. All I can tell you is that from just 10 days ago being in Chicago and seeing half a Wrigley Field, you know, be Blue Jay fans, to watching us in Seattle, which is thousands of miles away from here, and seeing the entire ballpark full of Blue Jay fans that are coming down from British Columbia that, you know, aren't even near Toronto, the, you know, to watching the steady stream of people come in here, you know, every night. Over 3 million, you know, fans. It's remarkable. I mean, it is, you know, I don't know how fragile it is. And, you know, I'd love to say we're never going to find out. But the reality is that the way this team was built is going to cause some correction at some point, that we've got to kind of retool and go through and regenerate, you know, a younger team at some point. I'm hoping that what we've done is kind of ignite not just a love for winning, but a passion for the Blue Jays in baseball, because it's incredible to feel now.
Under your watch, the Indians ballpark, which has been through a couple of different names, underwent some major changes. You also run the Rogers Center as part of your job.
Yeah.
I've heard there are plans for refurbishments and all sorts of other things. What are you hoping to accomplish in terms of transformations of this ballpark over the next however many years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the very simplest level, we want to transform it from a stadium to a ballpark. And I think it was built in an era when, you know, symmetry, kind of generic, you know, concrete structures, multi-purpose was a big part. And we want to make it, you know, a baseball ballpark. You know, now that's going to be a challenge because it's got 4 walls and a roof, which I'm very happy about, you know, in April and May. But I think we can do it. It's a great challenge. We also need to adapt it from the standpoint of when this stadium was built, just like Progressive Field or Jacobs Field, you know, it was pretty much, A, you were competing against standard definition television, so it wasn't that hard to differentiate from the home product, which is not the case anymore. Not only do we have HD TV, surround sound, you know, great home product, we also have mobility where people can watch it in HD everywhere they go. So you've got to create a more compelling fan experience, and you've got to allow for the fact that different people want to watch the game in different ways. Some people just want to be at the game in a great bar, you know, that happens to be in a stadium and kind of casually look at it. Some people want to sit from base to base and score the game the same way they always have, and you've got to provide them that. And some people want to bring their family and have a lot of their activities for their kids. So I think you need to target the different segments of your fan base. You need to provide them with different ways to experience the game, and understand that that's going to be important because it's got to be compelling. It, you know, the number one thing that compels people to come is winning. But what you want to do is have other things besides that, that in a down cycle will also create a desire to come to the game.
You mentioned earlier that you're all competitors at heart, you want to win. How tough is it, or was it, to go through the beginning of this season the way that the Jays got out of the gate?
I tend to, even after 20, even in your 26th year, it doesn't get easier, you know, when you lose. I mean, and I think the day you wake up and you feel as good getting out of bed when you lose, you do when you win, you're probably in the wrong line of work. It's time to move on to something else. So what I always try to do is turn that to fuel and motivation and desire to, you know, to focus on solutions, to focus on what you can control. So the most important thing is to kind of take that bitterness you feel when you lose a game and say, okay, what can I do to be productive with that? You know, how do we, you know, how can we win? How can we get better? Where are the opportunities? And sometimes what, you know, fans don't think about is that the major league team's just the tip of the sword, but underneath it, you know, you've got where the bulk of the work is being done. And baseball allows you, whether it's the draft, the player development system, you know, international and Latin America, baseball allows you so many other things you can focus on that are important to take care of to ensure that if you want to have a sustainable championship team, you better be paying attention to the details, all of them, up and down the organization.
Given the tight nature of the American League East and the wild card races and the second wild card, what goes into the decision to buy, to sell, to stand pat before the trade deadline this year, knowing sort of how jumbled the American League is?
Well, I mean, I think first you look objectively, you know, at your circumstance and your situation. You know, you factor in, you know, what your people are telling you your chances are. Then you subjectively look at, you know, who you have in place and what you believe. You look at the other situation and circumstance. We talked about what's happened in Toronto. We talked about how recent that really is. And I do think that I look out at the 3 million fans or the, you know, tens of thousands of fans that come here every night, and I think our job is to give them something to cheer about. And so if we have a chance, you know, that we may, while the intellectual exercise may say we should probably blow it up and rebuild, that the, you know, that the decision you arrive at may not be that, because, you know, hey, what we have here is so recent and so special that we need to do everything we humanly can to keep it open as long as we can, yet still balance that with a sense of urgency to infuse talent every opportunity we have. So we've done that in small ways, whether it be Teoscar Hernandez this year, whether it be the Liriano trade last year, where we also got two prospects, you know, and, you know, feel like we're focusing on duality right now. At some point, we may turn more one way than the other. It may not be the fastest way. It's not the way the Cubs and the Astros, you know, kind of built what they're doing, but it's the way that fits our situation. So every situation is different.
When you take over a new team like you did less than 2 years ago, how long does it take to get a real true assessment of what you have in your system and sort of what direction you need to take?
Well, I mean, I think the most important answer to that is it would have taken, you know, a long, long time had we made changes to a lot of people. But Joe Sheehan, instead of changing Joe, we promoted him from, you know, manager of analytics to director of analytics to assistant GM in a short period of time. There's got, you know, hosts of other people that are still here that were here before. So they help you because they know the situation, they know the organization, they know, what was traded, they know what's still here. And, you know, you've got good people around you that every day are kind of helping you assess where you are. And the most important thing is to have a plan and a strategy and to stay consistent to that, continue to evaluate it and have it evolve, but stay consistent to a set of values and a vision you're driving towards. And once you have an organization aligned behind that, you know, great things can happen and you continue to have a consistency in the work you do and the decisions you make.
How do you assess your farm system right now?
Much better. You know, much better than it was 2 years ago. Probably in the upper half, maybe closing in on the upper third, but not where it needs to be. You know, I think really excited about what's happening to at High A, at Dunedin and below, Florida State League and below. Still concerned about Double A and Triple A, and you know the depth of prospects there. But I look at Dunedin, you know, Lansing and our three short season teams, and you know, to have all three short season teams in postseason and well above 500 and with talented players, and to look at, you know, our left side of the infield and in Dunedin and really even Kevin Biggio to the right of second base, but to look at Bo Bichette and Vladdy Guerrero Jr. and some of the other players there, and to say, you know, to think that, to know what it takes from having seen it in Cleveland, you just don't need two guys. You need waves of guys. And then behind them, you need another wave of guys. And so I feel like that's coming. It's probably 2 to 4 years away that it's going to get here. But that when it comes, you know, what we've continued to execute on and what, where it's Andrew Tinnish leading us in international, you know, we've got waves of guys coming. And so I'm encouraged by that.
We've seen teams essentially rebuild their farm systems, or at least the upper echelons of their farm systems, with one or two big trades. Josh Donaldson's going to be a popular topic for the next year. He's got a year left on his contract. Is there a thought, and obviously you're not going to reveal your plans, but when you have a guy like that who's approaching his final year free agency, do you have to consider all options when you're going into this winter and then next season?
Yeah, I mean, I think you walk through all alternatives at every decision-making juncture, like I alluded to. And in this situation, the desire to win, you know, and to continue to give a relatively new fan base, because a lot of the fans that are coming are new fans. A reason to cheer and to come to the ballpark is probably more important than just maybe pushing the express button on how to regenerate and reinvigorate the farm system. So we've tried to balance that by understanding that we're doing a lot of that work at the lower levels. But, you know, the next juncture to look at that will be the off season. The next juncture after that will be, you know, the trade deadline. And when we think that we no longer have the opportunity to build a contending team, whoever's here, we're going to have to consider, you know, do we trade those guys? Not JD specifically, but whoever it is, we'll have to consider, can we do things that help us, you know, when we're able to be a contender again?
You traded away some popular players during your time in Cleveland. Roberto Alomar, CeCe Sabathia both come to mind. How tough is it to make those decisions when you know that in the immediacy of them, they're not going to be very popular with your fan base?
By the way, that list is a lot longer than that. Bartolo well, Colon, yeah, in my mind, Cliff Lee, sure. I kept going on.
Sure.
There may not be a tougher thing, you know, for a leader of a baseball organization. But the reality is that your job is kind of have one eye on today and one eye on the future. And you have to understand that every constituency that you know is invested in what you do, whether it be your internal, your players, your coaching staff, or the people that work on the business side of the organization, they are only concerned with right now, this moment. And your fans are only concerned with this moment and winning. And yet, you're one eye on the future, and the rest of the baseball operations, one eye on the future, you know, may sometimes lead you to make a decision that disappoints, you know, people that are focused on right now. So there is a toughness, you know, that is required to do these jobs, you know, that you know you're making the right decision, you're confident in that, and you believe in it. And you have the strength to articulate that, even though you know it's unpopular. If you're concerned with being popular and being liked, these probably aren't the right jobs for you. You know, I've always felt like you're trying to help provide a winner to the people that care, but you want to be right in the end, not along the way.
You once said you don't do this job to be mediocre. Will anything short of a World Series title for the Blue Jays make this a successful run for you here in Toronto?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think as I've aged, maybe I think, you know, creating a organization, you know, where people, a group, you know, 500 people enjoy working, are fulfilled, are challenged, get better, grow and build a sustainable championship organization. So there's so much randomness that when you get into the postseason, to strictly base all of your success on whether or not you win a World Series, I think you're probably setting yourself up for a pretty fragile existence. So once we, you know, have elevated process here and put people in place and in a structure that, you know, there is an incredible work being done everywhere, and an incredible culture where people are driven to get better and challenging each other to get better, and, you know, I think the results will follow that. But I want us to be in position to win that World Series every year. Short of that, I can tell you it will be a failure to me. Whether or not we do it, I'm not sure I'll judge success or failure strictly based on that.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
All right, mine too. Thanks, Mark.